Now, the next, number 8 through 16, these have to do with eliminating obstacles to the far-reaching attitude of ethics. And so they deal with very much the bodhisattva practice of ethics. Now remember, you know, as a prelude to the bodhisattva practice of ethics, you practice the pratimoksha level of ethics. Pratimoksha means self-liberation, and these are your 5 precepts, your 8 one-day precepts, the monks and nuns vows. Okay, those are all the precepts for self-liberation, or the Sanskrit word is pratimoksha, individual liberation. So with those, you know, the pratimoksha vows are very much dealing with very clear-cut situations. Don't say this, don't say that, don't do this, don't do that. Really dealing very much with verbal and physical actions. And, you know, it's real clear cut. So this is kind of adding on to that, really showing us how to practice that as a bodhisattva, how to practice ethics as a bodhisattva. So the number 8, which is the first one of referring to the far-reaching attitude of ethics, is forsaking those who have broken their ethical discipline, not giving them advice or not relieving their guilt. Okay, so somebody who has broken their ethical discipline, let's say a monastic who has broken their vows, or a lay person with the 5 precepts who has broken their vows, something like that, if we then go, ooh, you know, you're a horrible person, you're a sinful person, you're an evil person, you broke your vows, I don't want to be anywhere near you. You know, how could you have done such a horrible thing? You know, you just kind of totally from the root, you did this horrible action, and, you know, just get out of here, I don't want to see you. Okay? So that having that kind of rejection or uncompassionate attitude towards somebody who's goofed. Yeah? So what this vow is saying is that, you know, when people have, you know, breaches in their ethics, it's really our responsibility to have a compassionate attitude towards them and to help them. In other words, to help them by teaching, you know, encouraging them to do purification, encouraging them to go to their teacher or go to their abbot and admit their mistake, or go in front of the Sangha community and admit their mistake. Okay? So instead of just kind of being disgusted with somebody and kicking them out with a real, you know, angry or a self-righteous mind, I'm so pure in ethics, how could you do something like that? You know, that kind of attitude, to really, you know, help them and help them to purify, help them to make amends. Now, this is very different than if somebody has broken their vows and they're coming to you and encouraging you also to break your vows. Okay? Now, if that's the situation, then you have to be real clear with the person and you don't want to hang around them. But if this isn't that kind of situation, you know, where you can really, this is a situation where there is a potential that you could positively influence that person and help them make amends, then we shouldn't exclude them from our compassion or belittle them or not forgive them or not help them or rebuke them or something like that. Okay? So this is really hitting the self-righteous mind. Yeah? And the mind that, because we have a hard time accepting sometimes when other people make mistakes because we really want to put people up on pedestals. Yeah? So sometimes we put people up on pedestals, and then, you know, even our regular Dharma friends, and then they break their vows, and then we get really angry at them because it's like, I needed you to be on a pedestal. I needed you to be a good example. I needed you to be perfect. How can you let me down and not be perfect? Get out of here. Yeah? And we get real angry or you know, self-righteous. So to watch that. Because I find that especially in America, you know, we love to, you know, put people up and then rip them down. Yeah, we do it in politics, we do it in virtually everything. Okay, then number 9, not acting according to one's vowed trainings when it would generate or sustain faith in others. So, when we have taken, you know, the 5 precepts or, you know, other kinds of precepts, then it's good if we have, you know, if, you know, it's not so good to kind of neglect them anyway. But especially if it's going to harm somebody else and make them lose faith, then it's kind of like a double whammy because we hurt ourselves and we hurt them. So this is really pointing out to us that when it's, you know, really important that for others' faith, we should be real careful about our actions, okay, and make sure that we keep our precepts well. Okay, so in general, I mean, what this vow is encouraging us to do is to act and speak and do things in ways that generate faith in others. So another instance of this is if somebody is asking you for a particular teaching or particular instruction, then even though it might not be your favorite practice, and even though it may not be a particularly bodhisattva practice or whatever, if it's something that would benefit that person and generate faith in them, then we should give that. Okay? But if we refuse and we say, well, that's not my favorite practice, so I'm not going to teach it, or, you know, something like that, then that would be counteracting this. So that would, you know, is one kind of an example. Other kinds of examples, just very rude behavior. Things that would make other people lose faith in us, you know? So especially, you know, in situations where we're acting as representatives of the Buddhist community, you know, we just kind of go around huffing and puffing and slamming doors and commanding people to do this and that and being really bossy and loud and obnoxious. I mean, it makes people lose their faith. You know? So just to be aware of that and to watch our behavior in that way. This does not mean that you have to get all uptight about, oh, God, I'm representing the Buddhist community. Am I doing it right? You know? Because we tend to get real uptight about, am I doing it right? And just get neurotic, okay? So this vow is not saying get uptight and neurotic, okay? Buddha didn't need to instruct us how to do that. Yeah, we are very good at that on our own. So that's not what the vow is saying. What the vow is saying is just, you know, when we are in just to be mindful of our behavior and how it influences others, and to be aware that if, you know, we're acting really bossy and like a big mouth and, you know, and just huffing and puffing and slamming doors and stuff like this, then it's going to give people a certain view of maybe what Buddhism is. Or maybe what we are as people that wouldn't benefit the other person. And so since in our heart what we're really wanting to do is to be of service and benefit to others, then to be aware of our behavior and act appropriately. Okay, so for example, you know, other examples would be getting drunk. Yeah? Going somewhere, getting drunk, acting really boisterous, you know, smoking. Any smokers in this group? You know, womanizing, menizing. you know, things that would cause people to lose faith. Okay, then the 10th one. Doing only limited actions to benefit sentient beings, such as strictly keeping the Vinaya rules in situations when not doing so, would be of greater benefit to others. So whereas number 9 is really emphasizing to us the importance of keeping the Vinaya or the Pratimoksha vows, this one is saying, you know, if you go to an extreme and there's a very small Vinaya. Vinaya means the monks and nuns discipline, or Pratimoksha, your 5 lay precepts. If there's a, you know, a small situation of those versus a big benefit to others that could be done if you didn't keep that so strictly, then we should go for the thing that benefits others. Okay? So one of the classic examples is monastics are not allowed to touch people of the opposite sex. Okay? So if some man is drowning in the river and I go, I'm sorry, I can't save you, I'm a nun, you know, then that's not very compassionate. Then it makes much more sense for me to jump in and, you know, and save him. I hope he doesn't weigh too much. Yeah? So, or the same thing for a monk. Yeah? Or other pratimoksha vows. For example, I have a vow not to ride in a vehicle. Okay. Now, if I kept that vow very literally, it would be extremely difficult to benefit sentient beings. So for the benefit of sentient beings, I have to not follow that vow literally. Okay. Now, the reason that vow was made was because in ancient India, when you rode in a vehicle, it was usually either pulled by a person or pulled by an animal. So it was something that was causing others duress. Or, also in ancient India, when you rode in a vehicle, it was very easy to get proud because not many people rode in vehicles. So in order to prevent monastics from getting proud, then, you know, there was this vow. But nowadays, if I were to keep that really strictly, it would definitely impinge upon my ability to benefit others. Okay? So what this vow is saying is in those kind of circumstances, the thing that's for the greater benefit is what we should do.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't they change the vow like that? This is... We Westerners look at things very different than the Asian society. At the time, you know, when the Buddha was dying, the Buddha said to Ananda, his attendant, you can change the minor vows. Okay? If the congregation gets together, the assembly of elders gets together, they can change the minor vows. Now, Ananda did not ask which were the minor vows and which were the major vows. So because of that, all the future generations, they don't want to goof and change something that might be a major thing. So they say better just keep it exactly the way the Buddha taught it. Now you will find, you know, like in Thailand, there's certain vows that they keep very, very strictly that in China and Tibet, you know, they don't. And even, you know, but even not all of the vows in the Vinaya do the Thais keep completely literally either. I mean, Ajahn Amaro and I were talking about it, and he rides in vehicles too. It's quite interesting. I saw a video once of a conference where they had some Western monastics and Eastern monastics, and this specific topic came up. And this... And, you know, the Asian monastics were saying, well, if you change this one, this vow, you know, about riding in vehicles, then you're going to change this one, then you're going to change this one, then you're going to change this one, and pretty soon we're not going to have anything left. And one Western nun came up and said, but the practicality of it is we keep the vows exactly the same, and then people just interpret them differently themselves and don't keep them literally anyway. So then what you're doing is you're developing in people's minds a mind that says, well, I don't have to keep these. You know? So then, you know, you're going to break this one, and you're going to break this one, you're going to break this one, you're going to break this one. So she kind of gave the same argument, but, you know, showing it from the other viewpoint. So, you know, what's basically happened is that everything's kept as the Buddha laid it out, but then the traditions interpret it their own way. And even within it, any particular tradition, different monasteries, different teachers will interpret them, you know, differently. I think it'd be hard. No, those are two different things. It was, he was saying we could call a conference together of all the elders of all the traditions, which is what it would mean to change the Vinaya. is you'd have to get the elders of all the traditions together and do that. And, I mean, that's kind of impossible. So what His Holiness was wanting to do was get some of the elders in the Tibetan tradition together, and of course they would never change anything literally in the vows, but they would talk about how to reinterpret things. And then certain passages that were written later, let's say in the ordination ceremony, that were gender biased, then those things they could admit because that came later. That wasn't something that the Buddha actually said. Okay? So they wouldn't be changing the vows, they would just be interpreting them. And they would be omitting some of the things that were developed later, let's say by previous generations of Tibetans. Possibly, yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, I'm hoping at least it'll change the seating arrangement in the West. And my personal feeling is, because in Dharamsala, I mean, if they tried to change the seating arrangement in the East, everybody would just freak out. I mean, the nuns would never sit equal to the monks. They would just feel incredibly uncomfortable with it. So I think, you know, I doubt that it would change so much in Asia. But whether or not they change or not, I think here we have to change.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, but we sit mixed with the lay people. I mean, what happens, usually in the Tibetan things in Dharamsala, the monks serve first, then the nuns, and then the lay people. In the Western section, the lay people sit first, and the monks and nuns are scattered anywhere they can squeeze themselves in. So, I think if anything in the Western section, it needs to become a little bit, you know, more traditional. I must say, it's not a thing of pulling rank or hierarchy. It's a thing of being practical, because as a nun, I mean, this has happened to me in Dharamsala, you know, because I've had to sit in back of lay people. Then I, as a nun, I'm sitting there, and there's a couple in front of me at the teachings, and the couple are, you know, this and this, and, you know, at the teachings, and I'm trying to listen to the teaching, you know, and I'm sitting right looking at them, and it's really distracting. So I could see some reason for those people sitting behind the monks. Yeah. I mean, that makes some sense to me. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so what we, you know, what it's saying is that when there's a greater benefit to be achieved, then it's, you know, if you keep strictly to small Vinaya vows, then it's kind of going against the Bodhisattva's purpose.